Blog Talk Radio.
Facebook Live and on you listening on Blog Talk Radio. So excited to be back. I guess I was here last week, but I travel so much, it's hard for me to keep track where I am. This last week was Texas and Denver. Some good events. Nice meeting many of you. It's always good to meet and to get to know some of the people listening to the show. So really enjoyed meeting many of you. Next week, Arkansas and Chicago. Week after that is going to be Dallas and Austin, if I remember right. And then the week after that, who knows? Week after that is University of Virginia, Washington, D.C., and New York City. All right. So today we're going to be doing an attempt to evaluate the Trump administration over the last 8 years. So we're going to try to objectively assess good, bad, mediocre, worst president in American history, as some would claim. Talk about a little bit about people's attitudes towards Obama. Obama is a very incredibly divisive president. There are many of those who believe he is one of the great presidents of all time. And many who believe he's the worst president of all time, and many believe he's, the number of rumors about that he wasn't born in the United States, that he's a Muslim, that he's really a Muslim Brotherhood, that he is the Manchurian candidate working for the benefit of Islam, that he wants to destroy Europe by creating a massive immigration crisis of moving Muslims dramatically into Europe. All of that, he has been blamed for every evil in the world, and of course among certain elements in the progressive movement has been considered one of the great benefactors of mankind, although there are many critics of Obama among the progressives. So many people on the left disappointed because he didn't do enough. All of that we are here to talk about, here to evaluate. And I'm curious to hear what you guys have to think about Obama. So you can call in 347-324-3075. And what I'm asking is, let's say the first 45 minutes or so, call in with a point of view about Obama. What do you think about his presidency? What stands out in your mind in terms of the pluses or minus? What do you think the theme of his presidency is? What will he be remembered for? What animates this presidency in a sense differently than, let's say, any other presidency? What is uniquely Obama? And again, 347-324-3075. Also, don't forget a live tweet the broadcast. That always helps. Hashtag Yaron Brooks Show. Quotes, impressions on the show, anything that comes up during the next 90 minutes, please tweet it. Get the word out there. I guess you could also Facebook it. I guess that would also generate something similar to what live tweeting it would do. The basic idea here is to get it out to your followers so that we can expand the reach of the show and attract more people to the show. I'm being told that the sound is low on the Blog Talk Radio feed, so let me try to adjust that if that is true. I don't know if that's a person. All right, that should fix it. So let me know if that fixed it. still playing around with my new board, where all the sound is connected to everything and so on. I have a feeling that probably spiked the volume on the Facebook Live, but all right, here we go. Volume is now higher. So hopefully that solves the problem. You can always decrease the volume on your computer. All right. So what do I think? What do I think of the Obama years? Is Obama as bad as many conservatives and objectivists and libertarians and alt-right people? Is he as bad as everybody else claims he is? Or is that all exaggerated? I'm going to make the volume even higher just for the hell of it. Okay, hopefully that'll work. How do we assess it? How do we approach this objectively? What is the primary characteristic of the Obama presidency? Again, you can call in with your views, 347-324-3075. And let me just say in advance, because I think many of you are going to be disappointed a little bit in me. That seems to be a feature lately. I think Obama's a terrible president. I think he's one of the worst in American history. I don't think he is the worst. I don't think he's as bad as many of you claim. I think primarily he'll turn out not to be as bad as many claim, because he had to deal with the Republican Congress for 6 out of his 8 years, which stopped much of the damage he could have done. He could have done. So it sounds like, one second, let me see if I can do something about the sound should not be low on Facebook. So if it is, then test it again. And I'm not sure where the buzziness will come from. One second, let me do this. Let's see. Let me know if the sound is any better on Facebook Live and any better on BTR. And we'll keep moving ahead. Hopefully the buzziness is gone and the volume is still reasonable. It's I don't know what I need. I think really what I really need is a producer. Sounds okay here. So, all right. So we got disagreement about the quality of the sound, and we'll try to, hopefully it's tolerable on the different. So I guess when I get too close to the mic, it starts clipping. So sorry about all the technical sound, all the technical aspects of this. I'm going to try to adjust some of the Facebook Live here, because it does look to me like it's too loud. Sorry. All right. Let's. Okay, hopefully that is better, but we will see. I need a producer. I really do need a producer, and I need funds. Anyway, in the next year, we're gonna professionalize this show, and we're gonna turn it into one of the most downloaded shows, podcasts in the country, and we're gonna get all of this professionalized and up to speed. All right, so. What, in my view, characterizes the Obama presidency? So let me just say, I don't think there's any conspiracy here. I don't think Obama is in the pocket of any Islamist group. I don't think Obama is a secret Muslim brotherhood. I don't care if he's a Muslim. I don't think he is. I think he's a typical Christian secularist, really. I don't think there's any conspiracy theory. I don't think Obama... is I don't even think Obama is a thorough, committed nihilist. I think Obama's presidency is characterized by an increased commitment to altruism and collectivism. And I think Obama is as close to a nihilist as we've ever had as president, But I don't think he is a committed nihilist. He is not out to just smash stuff. I think he doesn't care once in a while when stuff gets smashed. I think fundamentally he's anti-American, and that maybe is the most unique characterization of him, is the fact that he is not an admirer of America. He does not believe in American exceptionalism. He does not buy into America as a special country, as a unique country, as a country better than the rest of the world in its founding principles, because I don't think he believes in those founding principles, and he doesn't believe those founding principles were ever implemented. I think on top of that, one of the themes that comes across when you look at the Obama presidency is just incompetence, an incompetent president and an incompetent administration. So incompetence through and through. But philosophically, I think Obama was both the most anti-American, if America is understood as a pro-individualistic country, a pro-freedom country, an anti-American president, an anti-American exceptionalism president, and a president really committed to the ideas of altruism and collectivism, animates his entire presidency. So where other people see conspiracy theory, I just see altruism. When other people see a commitment to, to destroying the West, I just see collectivism. Now, yes, in a sense, a commitment to collectivism isn't a commitment to destroying the West. But it's not conspiratorial. It's just a consequence of philosophy. And this is a theme I want to keep going back to over and over and over again in this show. What drives history is philosophy. What drives history are ideas. Not conspiracies, not elites conspiring behind some curtain. Not some hidden agenda. The agenda's not hidden. The agenda's not hidden. Right? So Obama is, anti-American, in that sense, anti-Western, right? Anti-Western. He rejects what I have said on this show and in many other occurrences are the chief characteristics of Western civilization. And the chief characteristics of Western civilization are individualism and reason, the efficacy of reason, the belief that reason is our basic means of knowledge, our means of knowledge, right? Not necessarily in the objective fullest sense, but in the Enlightenment sense, in the sense that bring everything before reason. Knowledge comes from reason, not from revelation, not from intuition, not from, emotion. So reason and individualism, in my view, are the characteristic of what makes Western civilization. And I believe that in that sense, almost everybody on the political spectrum is anti-Western, because almost nobody on the political spectrum is for reason and individualism. So what makes Obama unique in that sense is anti-Americanism more than anything else, right? It wasn't so much that he's anti-Europe. I don't think he is. I think he adores Europe. I think part of his goal in his whole 8 years was to try to make America more like Europe, to try to knock us down in the sense that we believe somehow, in some way, that we are better than Europe. He tried throughout the 8 years to make us feel like we're no better than the Europeans, that we're the same as the Europeans. His goal was not to make us feel like we're as good as people in the Middle East or we're as good as people in Africa. I don't think he went that far. I don't think his nihilism or egalitarianism is that evil, if you will. But he definitely wants to make us more like the collectivistic Europeans, more like the altruistic and egalitarian Europeans. So, that's my kind of broad assessment. We're going to get into the details in a second. Let me just note, I'm noticing on Facebook Live, people are commenting. I can't keep track of what you're asking questions on Facebook Live, particularly if the questions you're asking on Facebook Live are not relevant to the actual topic I'm talking about, I can't hold it all. So what I suggest is if you have a question, call 347-324-3075. You can call whether you're on Facebook Live or whether you're on Blog Talk Radio. And that way I can answer your call, right? I can take your question. But if you post questions on the chat, on Facebook Live, hard for me to keep track of all that. So please just call in. Let me also say that what I'd appreciate is if on the next half an hour, next 45 minutes, you call in just on the topic we're discussing, I'll open it up to more general questions and more general topics after that. All right, we've got our first call. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Yeah, this is Evan from rural North Kakalaki.
North what?
North Carolina.
North Carolina. 336, I recognize that the area code is North Carolina. How's it going, Evan?
Very good. How are you?
Good, good.
One of the interesting things I think is that I've been observing is, I mean, people are always throwing at Trump, he's a narcissist, which he absolutely is, but completely overlooking Barack Obama's narcissism and his massive ego. Not like rational egoism as a, well, objectivist advocate for, but I mean, I remember whenever Arnold Palmer passed away and his Twitter posted a picture with him in the foreground putting and Arnold Palmer in the background and his disgusting speech that he gave to Black Lives Matter supporters about voting for him because of his legacy. And is there other examples that I can think of, anyone in the chat and or you, because I know there have been, I'm not a mind reader, but I think he views himself as a dignified statesman about legacy building.
I think that's right. I think most presidents do, at least particularly towards the end of their presidency. I do think he's definitely indications of his kind of his obsessions with his own value and his obsession, unhealthy obsession, it's all about him. And there certainly was a personality worship around him. And you could see that starting with the 2004, his talk at the Democratic National Convention and the media attraction and the fact that he was just, you know, a young senator and he's young and he's, you know, relatively good looking and he's fit and he's photogenic and he's articulate, at least with a teleprompter. And he has a certain charm to him. And I think the media was obsessed with it. And I think he became obsessed with the same thing. And I think that he only talks about the positives. This is something I think not unique to him. It's unique to many politicians in that they, you know, his last speech now about how wonderful the economy is and how wonderful foreign policy has become and all his achievements and all the good stuff. And of course, he doesn't say anything about the negatives and he doesn't say anything about the problems. But that's part of how political spin has become it and how these people view themselves as having careers beyond politics and therefore they're positioning themselves to what they're going to do beyond politics and how they're going to position their legacy and their library and all this stuff. And I think this is, I don't know how it was 50 years ago, but I find it hard to believe that presidents were like this 50 years ago. I think this is more of a current phenomenon, but I think it also reflects the American people's desire for kind of reality TV stars to be presidents, the cult of personality worship. And I think we become much more of a culture of personality worship than maybe we were 50 years ago. I don't think anybody worshipped Eisenhower. There was a bit of that with Kennedy, but I think he's probably the last one that other than Obama and now Trump, that really there is this focus on the personality of the president and a kind of a sense in which there is a personality worship of the president. And Obama played into that and he leveraged that and he used that and he enhanced that. So while I can't think of examples like this, because I have to admit, I wasn't really focused on this part of his presidency, this aspect of his presidency, it's definitely there. And I agree with you on that. And it's partially a reflection of our culture. It's partially a reflection back of where we are as America in terms of the culture. That makes sense?
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
yes,
sure.
Thanks for calling.
And I learned a new term, North Kakalaki. Was that something like that? Anyway, I've never heard that before. I know a lot of people from North Carolina, and I've never heard that particular reference to North Carolina. But I like to hear people who are listening to the show from all parts of the country and from all parts of the world. It's always fun. So again, let's return to this, the focus of my focus of, in my view, Obama was a reflection of his philosophy. He's a reflection of the idea that of altruism and collectivism and the idea of anti-Americanism. Now, let's try to do something that I know talk show hosts don't usually do. And let's try to really understand where this anti-Americanism comes from. And you know, try to make the best case for it possible, given Obama, right? And then we can, then I think we need to deal with it. But this is the Obama, and this is the left's perspective. And Obama being the first black president, I think here is very relevant. And this is, if you remember, Michelle Obama early on, I think right after he was elected, said something like, "I've never been proud of anything the United States has done until they elected my husband as president." And so here's the most credible case for this. I think the most credible case for it is the argument that America has this history of racism, that it has a history of slavery and then of institutionalized racism, and that racism was endemic in the United States, at least until the 1960s, and really to some extent still existed to this day, in a way that it's not been endemic in Europe, although, of course, we didn't have a Holocaust, did we? We didn't have anti-Semitism to the extent that they did there. But for somebody who's black, their perspective on the history of America has, by definition, to be different. I mean, their ancestors and their life experiences themselves are experiences of, at least to some extent, of racism, of discrimination, and way back, of actual slavery. And I don't think this justifies the idea of not completely getting American exceptionalism and not appreciating the role that America in its founding and in its ideas is what led to the elimination of slavery. But I think this is the perspective that they take. And certainly, if you remember that Obama used to attend Reverend White's church, where he was very, very, you know, anti-American history, brought up the issue of slavery and brought up the issue of discrimination and racism constantly. And again, with a grain of truth, or more than a grain of truth, with elements of truth to this, the Obamas came into the White House with a chip on their shoulder. The Obamas came into the White House with a chip on their shoulder. And as such, he is constantly trying to, and I think this explains some of this behavior of his, he's constantly trying to show, "I'm as good as anybody else. I'm actually better than anybody else." Right. Now, when it comes to race relations, which is interesting, the whole idea of race relations, I don't buy this whole idea of race relations. You know, it's ultimately individuals, but it in the sense of the sense of whether racism is on the increase, on the decrease in America today, you get a sense that things were much better or at least seemed to be moving in the right direction when Obama was elected. And indeed, that the fact that Obama was elected, that a black man was elected president of the United States, was an indication that America was getting over its racist past. And in that sense, things were getting better. One has a clear sense that post-Obama, things are worse, that Obama actually made things worse, that chip on his shoulder actually made many Americans angry, and that the fact that black Americans' lives actually did not improve economically for many during the Obama administration actually made their perspective worse. And then I think the case of some of these police shootings, the fact that we now have video of these police shootings because people can use their phones as cameras, the fact that we're exposed to some of the barbarity that indeed the police were have probably been engaged in for a long, long time. We exposed to it now. Again, I think that was overplayed in the sense that not all the shootings that were described as racist were racist, but a few of them were, and everything was lumped together. The rise of Black Lives Matter, which is a clearly racist, element, and takes on a racist agenda and a radical kind of anti-capitalist, anti-individualist, anti-freedom agenda. I think the rise of the Black Lives Matter, which I think ultimately has resulted in the rise of elements like the alt-right, that race relations have gotten worse, that probably racism, left and right, has gotten worse, that racist elements on both of those sides have gotten worse over the Obama presidency, and that we end Obama presidency in a much worse condition, much worse state. Certainly, I think what is going to aggravate it and what has aggravated it is the election of Trump. But of course, Trump, I don't think would have been possible if not for Obama and his presidency and everything that's happened around Obama's presidency, partially, if you will, the complete impotence of Republicans to do anything during the Obama administration, in spite of the promises they kept making that they would do stuff. Okay. So Obama, in my view, anti-American, driven by a conventional philosophy of altruism and collectivism and a tinge of nihilism, which is driven by his anti-Americanism. That is, because America is put up on a pedestal, and because from his perspective and many perspectives on the left, America has committed all these sins and indeed was born with this original sin called slavery, knocking America down a few notches has been a real focus of this president. Has been a real part of his agenda from the beginning of the presidency. Again, I don't believe there's Obama is about conspiracies. I don't think Obama is about some attempt to control, elite attempt to control the world. In a sense, it is an elite attempt to control the world. That's his collectivism. I'll get to that. But the idea that our lives need to be guided by experts, the idea that there are people who know better how we should live our lives and what we should do, you know, that is, at the end of the day, what collectivism is about to a large extent. As Leonard Peikoff, defined or described collectivism as collectivism, or attributed this to collectivism. Collectivism maintains that an elite endowed with special mystical insights should rule men. So again, collectivism, the philosophy, the idea of collectivism maintains that an elite endowed with special mystical insights should rule men. And I believe that Obama believes that, and I believe he's part of that elite. He's smarter than the rest of us. He's connected and has knowledge that the rest of us don't have. In some sense, philosopher kings, Plato's philosopher kings, and he has the knowledge and he has the ability that makes it possible for him to decide what's good for all of us. And that's not unique to him. That's prevalent in our intellectual circles. It's prevalent view in our political circles. He manifested, and he was in some ways proud of it. He never actually said it because it's one of these things you don't actually say, you never say, but he acted like that. He knows best. And this is the whole idea behind central planning, right? You don't know how to rule your life. Markets don't know how to rule life because they just rely on all of our individual actions, individual decisions. And we're not good at that. We need a central planner who can allocate those resources better, more efficiently than what individual choices can do. Markets are no good at that. They are more important goals. They are more noble goals than what individuals are seeking, than what markets facilitate. And what we need is a central planner. What we need are intellectual elites who can guide us, who can help us, who can support us. And that was his economic policy from the beginning. Now let's go back a little bit of history and let's start with his economic policies, and we'll kind of go go through the different issues that were raised during the Obama presidency and look at them. But and I'm going to try not to spend too much time on any one of them because we could go on for a long, long time. There's so much to say, and it's 8 years, and so much happened, and so much of it is a mess. But let's take economics. Let's remember Obama came in January of 2009. The stock market was plummeting. It actually bottomed around March of 2009. We had just come through three scary, scary months, maybe longer, maybe 4 months, where Lehman had got bankrupt. AIG was bailed out. We got TOP. We were told that if we didn't get TOP, the world would end. We were told by the central planners in the Bush administration that the world was going to end if not for them. We had to bail out banks. Stock market was plummeting. Bush said that capitalism had failed. Alan Greenspan had said that capitalism had failed, and we needed a savior, and we needed to be saved. And Paulson and Bush were trying to reject capitalism in order to save it, or something. Do anti-capitalist stuff in order to save capitalism. It's some bizarre notion like that. This is all under Bush. And of course, in December of 2008, Bush bails out the auto industry. So our auto industry is bankrupt as part of this this big thing. There's suspicion, rumors that the Federal Reserve has bailed out hundreds of companies, rumors that are then substantiated by data that we get years later. And that the economy is in shambles and a disaster. We might be heading to a Great Depression. I mean, this was real. Hyperinflation, if you were listening to Peter Schiff, or Great Depression, if you were listening to a bunch of other economists. And Obama is elected. And of course, that was a bottom. That was so bad that today Obama can say things like, so this is a quote out of his recent speech, today, the economy is growing again. Wages, incomes, house values, and retirement accounts are rising again. Poverty is falling again. The wealthy are paying, quote, a fairer share of taxes, even as the stock market shatters records. The unemployment rate is near a 10-year low, and so on and so forth. How wonderful things are. And in a sense, he's right. Relative to where it was in January of 2009, things seem rosy and wonderful and great. Although, of course, if it was so rosy and wonderful and great, I doubt that Trump would have won the election. But we have to remember where we were. Now, Bush responded, I think, terribly to the Great Recession of 2008. From the beginning of 2008 through the end of his presidency, Bush was a disaster of epic proportions, in some senses worse than Obama, in terms of the economic policies he implemented. What Obama did in his first year as president was basically take what Bush had started and put it on steroids. All right. So Bush had a stimulus package of $300 billion, legitimizing the idea that the government can stimulate the economy by spending money, by taking taxpayer money and spending it. Okay. So Obama had a stimulus package of almost $1 trillion. Bush bailed out the auto industry a little bit. Obama bailed out the auto industry a lot. And by the way, one of the most damaging things of the Obama presidency, which you will not hear anybody else talk about, is the auto bailouts. Not just because he bailed out auto companies. Bush did that, and even Ronald Reagan did that in 1981. The real damage that he did was the way he did it. The auto bailouts were done in a way that completely undermined and undercut the rule of law. Contracts were thrown out of the window. Pressure was put on companies and shareholders and bondholders to settle in ways that they would never have if this had been left to the marketplace. So government undercut the rule of law. Now, to some extent, that was already happening. And I think this legitimized it for Obama under Bush. That is, when Bush bailed out some banks, didn't bail out others, chose winners and losers throughout 2008 in one of the most disastrous runs for any president ever in terms of the decisions they made. Obama again took that and put it on steroids. So if Bush could let Lehman Brothers fail in 24 hours, bail out AIG, then Obama could turn around and tell bondholders in General Motors and Chrysler that they were going to be screwed at the expense of the unions, and nobody blinked. And in my view, that legacy of contracts don't hold if the government doesn't want them to hold. Government will put pressure to establish who are the winners and losers in what have always been in America. Market decisions, legal transactions. We file for bankruptcy and we negotiate. Now it's politics. That might be the single worst thing Obama did, presidency, in terms of undercutting the rule of law, and as a consequence, giving people like Donald Trump new tools and ammunition in order to be chief central planner of the economy, like central planner in charge, which I think Obama is already has that tendency. Trump already has that tendency, and Obama has already laid a solid foundation for that. And to hell with contracts. To hell with the rule of law. To hell with equal protection before the law. No, we're gonna deal with everybody differently, and so on, right? So Obama took everything that Bush did and put it on steroids. I think it had devastating effects. I think the economy would have recovered much faster if not for what Obama did. Bush is more complicated to say how he should have behaved, because Bush was really dealing with a crisis, partially of his creation, but a real crisis. I think that could have been handled 1,000 times better. But suddenly, everything Obama did, starting in January on, that had to do with the economy, from stimulus to auto bailout to Dodd-Frank, to raising taxes, and you could go on and on and on, all had devastating effects, and of course have increased government debt dramatically, have increased the deficit dramatically, have increased our mortgaging of future generations and current generations dramatically, because the debt has a cost that we pay for in lower economic growth now. The more the government sucks out of the economy, out of the private economy, out of private hands, the less investment there is, the less consumption there is, but the less investment and saving there is, which is a drain on the economy, both short-term and particularly long-term. So what the Obama economy has basically done is he has sacrificed growth for the sake of redistribution of wealth. Redistribution of wealth, not necessarily to poor people. Some of the redistribution of wealth has gone to rich people. So just redistributing the wealth, right? The low interest rates and some of the stimulus packages have gone to subsidizing his favorite industries, or to subsidizing people in the stock market at the expense of savers and at the expense of a variety of different groups. And you can, it's very hard actually to sort it out who benefits from this kind of economy, who benefits from stimulus packages, who benefits from the different government policies, and who loses. And that's the problem with central planning. That's the problem with government control of the economy, is that there are always winners and losers. There's always anybody's gain is always at somebody's expense. It is a zero-sum world. It is a zero-sum, if not a negative sum. There's always losers. Right. So Obama just enhanced that. Now, that mixed economy, that cronyism, that redistribution of wealth, that all of that existed. Obama just took it to the next level. He made it a bigger deal. He entrenched it greatly. And again, why did he do it? He did it because that's what all the economists were recommending. At least all the economists that advise a Democratic president. So the advice he was getting from centrist and leftist was stimulus package. You got to raise taxes because the deficit is exploding. And we got to bail out the auto industry, because otherwise we're going to lose jobs. What would have Trump done? He would have bailed out the auto industry in spades. So what Obama did to the economy is not controversial. It's not out of the mainstream. As bad as I think it is, as awful as I think it is, as horrible as I think it is, because we could be growing so much faster and we could be doing so much better, it was pretty conventional, right? And the unemployment rate is at the near 10-year low. Yes, participation in the workforce is also very low, though it's improving in the last 6 months to a year, but it's still pretty low. And jobs are not very good jobs, and many of those jobs are part-time jobs when people prefer full-time jobs. The jobs are lousy, but that's all a consequence of economic policies he implemented that he was advised to implement by conventional economists. This is not Obama being particularly bad, right? In my view, Bush in this category is much worse, because Bush during that last year was a Republican, supposedly on the free market side, supposedly on the capitalism side, with an investment banker like Paulson as his treasury secretary, supposedly understanding how markets work. And here Bush does things just almost as bad as Obama, but in the name of saving capitalism. That's much worse long term for where the country's heading and for what it means to the defenders of capitalism than anything Obama did. Obama just did what Paul Krugman and George Stiglitz and a bunch of other Nobel Prize winning economists who are collectivists and altruists and in my view, ignorant of economics, told him to do. If he'd actually done more of what these, you have to call them mainstream economists, hold, we would be in worse shape. In worse shape. Luckily, again, he had a Republican Congress to deal with. That, and as a consequence of that, he couldn't pass a lot of the really, really damaging stuff that many economists and many advocates on the left were calling for him to do. And indeed, the left is very disappointed in how little the Obama administration has done, particularly on the economy, to redistribute more wealth, to strengthen unions, to reduce, quote, inequality, to do all the things that the left would have loved to do and that Obama couldn't do because the Republican Congress didn't allow him to do. But he did a lot of damage. He did a lot of harm. Bad, bad president. Let's take context. One has to talk about Obamacare. Now, I don't want to take too much about Obamacare. I'm going to do my – this week, I promise, because this week there really is an AM560 show. I'm going to talk about Obamacare and the AM560 show, both about the damage it's done and about – what Republicans, I think, should do and what they're likely to do and the whole mess that is Obamacare, seems to be Obamacare right now. But he was again, Obamacare is not anywhere near as radical as the progressives in the Democratic Party wanted. Although it, as I've said many times, it was set up to fail. So one day the progressives could say, look, we tried insurance, we tried markets, we tried exchanges, which is a market thing they would claim, and that all failed. So what we need is single payer universal health care. The government has to provide it because markets are failing. So it was a step in that direction, but it wasn't all out. Obamacare indeed is a disaster, just as they planned it would be. Obamacare was built to fail in order to bring a single payer government socialized medicine. But think about Obamacare. Obamacare is trying to take us to a step towards what Europe already has. And all our intellectual elites believe that we need a healthcare like Europe's. And Europe believes that. I mean, when I travel in Europe, the one thing that Europe thinks that's superior to the United States is they believe that the United States has lousy healthcare and that their healthcare is superior to the U.S. Now, I try to explain to them that that's complete BS, and even the good stuff that they have is all a consequence of their free riding off of the American healthcare system. But it's hard to convince them, and this is one area again where Obama has moved us closer to Europe, where he is adamantly trying to move as close to Europe because he is convinced in this platonic, detached from reality, but this is how collectivism shapes it, that the Europeans are right, that we need socialized healthcare, that markets distort healthcare. And again, almost all mainstream centrist and left of center economists to some extent believe this. And again, he's just following the mainstream. Again, this is an example of Obama not being outside of the intellectual mainstream of the country. The intellectual mainstream of the United States is anti-American. It's anti the individualism, the pro-free markets that is America. They want to socialize healthcare. That's pretty standard out there. They don't say it because there's a core of Americans who will fight that tooth and nail. But when you look at Americans who object to Obamacare and think Obamacare is bad, a significant number of those people think it's bad because it didn't go far enough. Not because they want, you know, a private healthcare, not because they want free market healthcare, but because they think it should be completely socialized. All right, so Obama's 8 years, economy-wise, have ended kind of on an up note, in a sense that the economy seems to be doing well. There was wage growth in this last year, and I think that's a tragedy, because his policies were awful. Everything he did really was a catastrophe. Everything he did slowed the recovery down, and the economy is not in good health in any significant way. Debt is out of control. People are not really working the jobs that they want. Wage growth is not where it should be. Corporate profits could be much higher. Everything across the spectrum could be better economically if not for the policy. Say, if he'd done nothing, things would be better. And yeah, it would be good if parts of the American auto industry had been restructured in Chapter 11. Remember, bankruptcy does not mean things go away. It means things get restructured. So it's sad. It's indeed tragic that things are looking up, because this is somehow legitimized his record. I would rather have us be, well, not really, but in terms of this aspect of the Obama legacy, I'd rather us be in a recession right now. All right. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Yeah, this is Nick.
Hey, Nick. How's it going?
Hey, going good, doing good. Can I go back to the race aspect that you were discussing on Obama? Because
sure,
I think that's
sure.
The most important part of his presidency. I think to combat altruism, we have to take away their most important tool. And there's no doubt that their tool is racism. They don't care about racism. They just use it as a tool to attack the right. And that's why it keeps coming up even before Trump every 4 years. That's their go-to insult. And they don't care. And I disagree. This country is not racist compared to the rest of the world. So there's really no black people have no complaints against this country at this time. All the problems of black people is self-induced. And their leaders are also giving bad advice.
Well, I mean, I somewhat agree with that, but I don't completely agree with it. So certainly America has a history of racism against blacks, which many parts of Europe do not. They also have a smaller black population,
right.
And they're probably changing. They're becoming more racially. And I think that racism in the past has made it more difficult for blacks to advance, to get. I think if you look at public education in black schools, it is horrific. It is terrible. And of course, that's public education. But public education in middle class neighborhoods is still bad, but it's much, much better.
But this has nothing to do with the racist past. This was 200 years ago we're talking about now. What does that have to do with today? They're free now. They are not slaves.
I was born in 1961.
And poor people. Go ahead.
I was born in 1961. In 1961, in the South, there were water fountains that said blacks only, whites only. There were bathrooms for blacks only and whites only. There were segregated schools, public schools that were segregated. This is 1961, the year I was born. If I had grown up in that kind of environment, that would have pissed me off. I would have been pissed off. Imagine fountains that said Jews only, non-Jews only, as relevant to me as a Jewish person. I would have been pissed off. It would have affected what I would have done in my future. Now, I agree with you that they've been self-destructive about it, and partially, to a large extent, their self-destruction is because they bought into the collectivism of the rest of society, which they are being taught, which then morphs very quickly into a form of racism, because that's the nature of collectivism. But you cannot whitewash the relatively recent history, which is only 50-something years old, so it's within a couple of generations, in which they were clearly, unequivocally being discriminated against. Now,
I see no reason why that should affect anything you do today. That 50 years ago, they couldn't drink in the same water fountain. I think that's complete BS. And today, when they're walking around, there's little racism, at least compared to the rest of the world. They have little racism. This is actually my lesser point, though. I wanted to stress the bigger point of that's their attack, that they don't care about racism. So the people, if blacks care about racism, the left is the worst person to follow because they don't actually condone racism. There was a case in Italy where a black politician was actually compared to an orangutan or something, and the person who compared to that was another politician. He wasn't removed. Nobody made a big deal about this. It only comes up. Have you ever heard a context where they bring up the KKK when it's not to attack a conservative? It's only they only care about the KKK to attack the right. They do not care about.
I think that's partially, again, I think that's partially true, but I think they care about KKK. I think everybody cares about KKK, and you're a victim of the KKK. You certainly care about them. But yes, they have used race as a political weapon. They refine the use of race as a political weapon, and they do it constantly. They use race as a political weapon, and in that sense, this is what I said, they are racist, and they have adopted racism as a way to attack the right, but also as a way to pretend, and this fits into what you're saying, to be victims, constant victims. However, I don't think that mitigates the fact that I do believe that if I had grown up in an environment, where there were white and black water fountains, that would have affected me, and I would have resented people for the existence of that and for the fact that people for many, many years longed for that past. I don't think one can wipe out history. History has an impact. Now, it's true that today, for the most part, for most Americans, racism has become a non-issue, although I believe it's still out there, and I've got there's plenty of evidence it's still out there. But it's lower, and it certainly still exists in Europe, and they somehow whitewash the fact that it exists in Europe. You should see what the Europeans do to black soccer players who get on a field in Europe and they play soccer, and the kind of name calling and ugliness that happens in Europe when black soccer players play. But I think it's a mistake. I think it's a mistake that we make if we belittle the impact that the history of racism in this country has had on individuals, because I think history plays a role in individuals. It's the same as people who grow up under regimes of anti-Semitism. It impacts the rest of their lives, and it impacts the way they treat other people, and it impacts their children. You become very defensive. You become all kinds of things because you view other people as a threat because you've lived under that threat. You've actually experienced that threat, and if you grow up under that, it's very difficult to change. Now, that doesn't justify them becoming racists, and it doesn't justify a civil rights bill that actually institutionalized racism in affirmative action. And I think if there is a rise in racism in America today, and I actually think there is, it is partially a consequence of the fact that people resent affirmative action and have resented affirmative action for almost 50 years since it is 50 years now, since it was put in place. I think it's because of the race baiting of the left. People as a counter response have become more racist to combat that. I think we have become a more racist society because left and right more as a response to the left than anything else, have adopted race as something important. But partially for the right or for us, because I don't believe I don't consider myself part of the right, but for us to negate the history of racism in this country, I think is a huge mistake. This is why I believe that the Confederate flag should not be flown over any public institution. I believe that as an individual flying the Confederate flag, you are identifying with racial policies, you're identifying with a racist past. and I find it offensive, and I think a lot of people should and do find it offensive. So I think that you have to take that into account, and you can't just reject that history, and you can't just, and the problem is that if we deny that that exists and we say, oh, there's no racism in America today, which is not true. We just have to explain the racism, and part of the racism is from the left, and part of the racism from the right is explained by the racism from the left, but we have to acknowledge it exists. And we don't acknowledge that the Confederate flag is a symbol of racism. Then we're making things worse, not better. We're making things worse, not better. Now, I believe that most of the Civil Rights Act was fine. It was those provisions that required people to serve everybody, those provisions that instituted affirmative action, those provisions have ultimately, long-term, made racism worse, not better. And I do think what the left has done, and has done for a long time, but under the Obama presidency, have refined it and done it even more so, and Black Lives Matter is the worst of these, is they are using race as a political weapon, and that's incredibly dangerous and incredibly evil. And particularly at a time where a black president was elected in the United States. I mean, how racist could America be if a black president is elected, and not a black president who's very mainstream, a black president who's pretty out there on the left and on some of this racial politics, involved in some of this racial politics. So, yeah. I mean, my view is the left is horrible, and you'll see this over and over again, and I know a lot of you resent this and don't like when I do this, but the fact is, as bad as I view the left, I view the right as bad as well, and that when the right tries to negate, for example, history, or when the right tries to embellish the presidency of George W. Bush, I think that those kind of things are mistakes, and we have to be objective. We have to be objective. And if you're black and you're driving around a car and you constantly get pulled over in a way that white drivers do not, right? And you get harassed by police in a way that whites are not, you're going to build up resentment for that. You put yourself in their shoes. You're not going to just say, well, I'm going to ignore that. I'm going to go on with my life. Now, again, that's not to blame the fact that they've institutionalized themselves into poverty, that they're not, that the leadership does not demand of them to be ambitious, to take responsibility for their own lives, to go out there and to overcome the obstacles that they have. That their leadership has demanded they become victims. The victim mentality is there. But there's also things that our culture still has part of that, you know, are bad. And we have to acknowledge those if we're going to fix them. All right. There's still a couple of big issues I want to cover under this Obama legacy thing. One has to do with foreign policy, and another one has to do with surveillance and free speech. And I don't know if you saw, but one of the last things Obama here has done is it expanded the powers of the intelligence agencies, including the National NSA, and it's the information that it accumulates and shares, and in scary ways. And it's kind of interesting for somebody who supposedly is on the left, right? Supposedly is on the left to have these policies that are, you know, that supposedly the left is supposed to be pro-free speech and pro-privacy. The Obama presidency blows that out of the water because the Obama presidency was anti-free speech and anti-privacy. And let's quickly go over that, and then I'll do foreign policy. So think about free speech. Obama as president. Now, these are things that nobody talks about, but Obama's presidency targeted more journalists than I think it was something like all presidents combined. The Obama presidency went after journalists to reveal their sources more than any other administration, and maybe more than all other administrations in the past combined. Here was a president that was horrific for freedom of the press. He has got the lowest ratings possible from all of the press freedom organizations. He truly has an awful record of press freedom. Right? Again, this is the collectivism. This is the idea that we as an elite, we know better. And we as an elite demand obedience. And we as an elite, this is the authoritarianism in Obama. We as an elite demand that you reveal our sources, demand that you follow our line. He doesn't believe in free speech. He wants a press to fall in behind him and do as he says. Right? Now, the same thing with whistleblowers. No administration has gone after government whistleblowers more than the Obama administration. No administration has gone after whistleblowers more than the Obama administration, government whistleblowers. Right? Why? Because government can do no wrong. Government can do no wrong. Government is this elite that is responsible for all of our lives. And whistleblowers undermine the idea of the central planner in the broader sense of knowing all that is good for us. This is real collectivism. This is real elite rules. This is real central planning. So he's just taking this to its logical consequences. And of course, one of the examples of this whistleblower were the people before Snowden who kept saying much of what Snowden said later, and nobody would listen to them. And they were prosecuted. Obama, here's a quote from an article I read, I think, in The Atlantic. The Obama administration has prosecuted 9 cases involving whistleblowers and leakers, compared with only 3 by all previous administrations combined. It has repeatedly used the Espionage Act, a relic of World War I era red baiting, whether that's true or not, I don't know, not to prosecute spies, but to go after government officials who talk to journalists. Now, that is one of the most condemning things I've heard about Obama. Under Obama, the Justice Department and the FBI, I'm quoting here, have spied on reporters by monitoring their phone records, labeled one journalist an unindicted co-conspirator in a criminal case for simply doing reporting and issuing subpoenas to other reporters who tried to force them to reveal their sources and testify in criminal cases. I mean, this is unbelievable. And this is supposedly, again, from the left. So, yeah, this is a quote from the New York Times, not from the Atlantic, from the New York Times article from December 20th. And actually what the article is making the case that if Trump is going to go after journalists, blame Obama, because Obama set the terms. And what Obama did was, basically Obama in a sense set it up for Trump to probably even be worse than this. We'll see. But he certainly looks like he's going to be worse than this. But Obama it's just really incredible how bad Obama was on this issue of free speech, how bad Obama was. And again, it's all consistent with this idea of greater role of government in our lives, more government intervention in our lives, more rule by elites who know better than us what's good for us. And basically set the table for Trump to be much, much worse and for future authoritarian to be much, much worse than he was. And here's a biggie, right? And this relates to the National Security Agency, right? The NSA, under Obama, really under Bush and Obama, and again, most of the bad things Obama did started with Bush, and even this whistleblower stuff started with Bush. Obama inherited some of these cases from the Bush administration. The whole Snowden revelations of what the NSA was doing under Bush and Obama, but particularly under Obama, accumulating massive quantities of data and information on us. I actually just watched the Snowden movie, which is not a very good movie, qua movie, but it's interesting. I found it fascinating. And I still hold that Snowden's a good guy. And the revelations are truly stunning in terms of the role of the NSA and our other and what the CIA does, and really horrific in terms of what our intelligence agencies do in terms of violating our rights, and in terms of the focus that they have is not on protecting us, is not on protecting us from bad guys, but on doing all kinds of other things that big government demands from them. Yeah, somebody's commenting on the fact that this article is in the New York Times. I know, but let me tell you, and this is the whole idea of, there are a lot of good articles in the New York Times. Not as many as they used to be 50, 100 years ago, but there's a lot. You know, not going to seeing an article in the New York Times and saying I'm dismissing it because it's in the New York Times, it's a big mistake. There's a lot of good reporting in the New York Times. There's a lot of good articles that come out of the New York Times. They're usually biased, but usually there's still a lot of worthwhile information in them. And you can, if you're sensitive to the bias, you can pull the bias out and you can segregate the good stuff from the bias. What I wanted to say was about the NSA. So think about the fact that Snowden happened under Obama. Obama went after Snowden with the Espionage Act, and I don't think this is going to get better under of course, Trump, because Trump has said that Snowden should be executed. Trump's CIA director or nominee for CIA director has said that Snowden should be executed. Flynn, Trump's national security advisor said that Snowden should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. So this is not going to change. But the fact is that it's going to get worse. But the fact is that this was all true under Obama. And Obama just approved this new, I guess it's an executive order, these new rules. I don't know the mechanism by which they get approved, which expand the power of the National Security Agency to share information that it gleans from its surveillance of international and domestic with 16 other agencies that make up the U.S. intelligence community. Now, there are a lot of aspects to this, but one of them is that in the past, they've shared this information after the NSA, has put on their privacy screens. That is, they have protected data that is irrelevant or that is personal and of American citizens before they shared it. What is happening now is they share it first, and all these other agencies, 16 of them, including the FBI, by the way, they are now responsible for putting on the privacy screens. So instead of, let's say, 100 NSA agents have access to data, now it's going to be thousands of all kinds of agents from 16 different agencies. Now, I'm not going to ask the question of why we need 16 different intelligence agencies. My guess is this is stupid and this is just bureaucracy and has nothing to do with actual national security. You know, but that's just another indication of how government has grown out of all proportion and out of complete control. So if the FBI gets all this information in context of some national security thing, but as it's going through all this raw data, it discovers that you, an American individual, whom they don't have a warrant against, has committed a crime, they can use that information to go after you. Now, this is completely wrong. This is a massive violation of our privacy, a massive violation of our rights as individuals. So, Obama's been terrible on the issue of privacy, terrible on the issue of free speech. Of course, on the issue of free speech, it's under his administration and not by accident. It's the rise of this crazy leftist ideology that is brought us the trigger warnings and microaggressions on campuses and the whole attack of free speech. Obama was terrible in Danish cartoons, just as Trump was terrible in the Danish cartoons. Obama was terrible on the whole issue of political correctness. All the people surrounding Obama, the whole intellectual movement that is Obama, raised that to really to a new level, the whole idea of political correctness. Terrible. But again, what you see here is not some special conspiracy. In my view, what you're seeing here is just statism, collectivism, and the demeaning of America in the name of altruism. We're too, you know, we're rich, so we can be pulled down a notch. And nowhere did that feature as much as in Obama's foreign policy. And this is where I think you see everything combined together. Altruism, collectivism, elitism, anti-Americanism, and incompetence. And that's what, to me, characterizes this administration. Altruism, collectivism, anti-Americanism, and incompetence. That's what this administration really symbolized. And you really get it in foreign policy. You really get an indication of it in foreign policy. The incompetence is unbelievable. Right? Now, let me be clear. I don't believe that they had a principled foreign policy and they were advocating a principled. No, I mean, the pragmatic application of the altruism, collectivism, and anti-Americanism. But you see a theme in this foreign policy that unites all that plus incompetence. So, you know, take Syria, right? A conflict that I believed America should have never intervened in because it had nothing to do with American national, you know, self-interest. There were other conflicts that we should have intervened in. There are other problems we should deal with, like Iran and Saudi Arabia, but Syria is not one of them. But Obama kind of intervened in it, drew red lines that then he failed on, that he didn't live up to. When the red line was crossed, he didn't live up to. That's weakness. He got involved in it because of the altruism. People are suffering, so we have to get involved. Help people who we didn't understand, didn't know, just incompetence. Much of the help landed up in the hands of Al-Qaeda and ISIS because, and again, I don't believe there's any conspiracy here. Because they are so incompetent, this is where he didn't, you know, people are saying the Obama administration instigated the Syrian civil war in order to cause a migration crisis in order to wipe out Europe. I mean, this is nonsense. They love Europe. And the fact is that they didn't instigate a Syrian civil war. The Syrian civil war was a consequence of, I mean, I can say a lot about the Syrian civil war, but the Syrian civil war was a consequence of the Arab Spring and the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood, and it had nothing to do with what the United States did or didn't do. All you can say about the United States and the Syrian civil war is that the United States acted incompetently and stupidly and altruistically, even to get involved in it and armed the wrong people. And the United States has no idea of a principled foreign policy. Now, if you go back to Obama's Cairo speech, and this is really Cairo's speech early in administration, sets the tone. Moral equivalency between Israel and the Palestinians, moral equivalency between the Muslim Brotherhood and anybody else, moral equivalency between the West and the Arab world. What was driving the Bush administration throughout, and that he set out explicit terms in the Cairo speech, was America is not special. America is not unique. Don't copy us. Don't use the American Constitution and Declaration of Independence as a model. Don't use American freedom and capitalism as a model for anything. Go out and do your own thing. Everybody's equal. This was the most multicultural speech multicultural in the sense that all cultures are equal, not in a sense of tolerance of other cultural, but all cultures are equal. It was the most multicultural speech, most anti-American speech ever given, most anti-Israeli speech ever given by an American president, and it set the tone. So Libya was a European war. We didn't need to get involved in Libya. It was the French and the Europeans that were pissed off at what was going on in Libya and started going after, what's his name? Now I forget his name. I'm getting too old for this because I can't remember people's names anymore. Muammar Gaddafi, right? So, and then we got involved, but we got involved as leading from behind, which is completely consistent with his Cairo speech of, we're not going to assert ourselves, we're nothing special, which is completely consistent with withdrawing from Iraq kind of stupidly, but staying in Afghanistan and getting killed. Why are we in Afghanistan? Why are we sticking around? We obviously don't want to win the war in Afghanistan. We're not willing to dedicate the resources to crush the Taliban. So why are we there? Just to get our kids killed. That's the only reason we're there, right? And then, of course, during the Arab Spring, we completely got Egypt wrong. Why did Obama support the Muslim Brotherhood? Because he loves the Muslim Brotherhood a little bit. He has sympathy for the Muslim Brotherhood, primarily because they constitute a majority of Egyptians. And because they are being excluded from political power in spite of the fact that they're majority. So every leftist in the world who believes in, quote, democracy, wanted to see the Muslim Brotherhood manifested democratic destiny. So what the Obama administration has gave them opportunity to do that. There were elections. The Muslim Brotherhood won. It was a disaster, which anybody could have told them. But it was the manifestation of democratic will of the people. So how could anybody be against it? So then when there was a military coup to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood and establish the government of General Sisi, the Obama administration was anti the new government and pro the Muslim Brotherhood. Why? Not because it's some conspiracy theory, because they love the Muslim world. No, because they love democracy, quote, in quotes, right? They love democracy. And the Muslim Brotherhood represented democracy. Again, they're too incompetent to have a conspiracy theory. They're too incompetent to have a conspiracy theory. So yes, they're anti the Obama administration's anti-Sisi, pro-Muslim Brotherhood. But this is all was set in motion again by Bush. It was Forward Strategy for Freedom, which is bring democracy to the Middle East. That I wrote about this with Ilan Giono over 10 years ago about Forward Strategy for Freedom. And I predicted the Arab Spring. I predicted the Muslim Brotherhood winning in Egypt. I predicted the catastrophes that would occur in Syria with ISIS and all in Iraq and ISIS and all of that. Nobody cares, right? But I predicted all that because it's obvious. It's not a conspiracy. It's just obvious if you understand altruism and you understand collectivism, you understand how democracy works, and you understand the mentality of the Middle East, that's what you get. That's what you get. And all Obama did was take a more consistently leftist, altruistic, collectivistic, and more explicitly anti-American approach to Bush's foreign policy. Very little difference between Bush and Obama when it comes to foreign policy. But the incompetence is amazing. I mean, Obama's pivot to Russia, and then Russia falls apart in terms of Russia-U.S. relationships. Then he pivots to China, the pivot to Asia, and the relationship with China falls apart completely when he pivots to China. I mean, the sheer incompetence, that to me, it should be the most striking thing about Obama. And this is why I think Hillary Clinton should have been crushed, because she was responsible for a lot of this foreign policy, and nobody raised it. Nobody raised it, not even Trump. Not even Trump. I mean, I would have run a campaign denouncing her every foreign policy move as destructive for this country. And look, I think that the reason somebody's asking me another thing, the reason that Obama continues the drone strikes is because I think he's anti-terrorism. I don't think he wants terrorism to be rampant in the United States and the Western world. I don't think he's pro-terrorism, in spite, again, of your conspiracy, some of you guys' conspiracy notions. I don't think Obama is pro-terrorism. But it's an easy, the drone strikes are an easy, low-risk way of showing the world that he deals with it, that feeling good about himself, that he dealt with it. You know, Obama ordered the assassination of Osama bin Laden, the capture and killing of Osama bin Laden. So it all bolsters his notion that, you know, he's still doing his job. He's still protecting Americans. He's not out for bloodshed. He wants America to be like Europe, but he's not anti-American, right? He's only anti-American in our sense that he's anti-individualism, anti-capitalism, but he's anti-America as Europe. So he doesn't want, he was, I'm sure he was horrified by terrorist attacks in Europe. I'm sure he doesn't condone them. So again, I disagree with many of you who think that Obama is a devil, a monster, a nihilist who wants to see everything shattered. I think he definitely wants to see stuff shattered, but it's limited. He's not an all-out, in Leonard Peikoff's term, D2. He's not a complete and utter hater and disintegrator. Otherwise, he would not have continued the drone program, and he would have done a lot more harm to the United States than he did. And I know many, you know, so I think that's, let me take a quick call because we're running out of time, and tell you about another TV show I'm watching. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Paul Kennedy.
Hi, Paul. How's it going?
Hello. Good. I'm in Austin, Texas, by the way.
Okay.
So I had a lot of thoughts, and I'll try to make it as quick as I can. I agree with a lot of what you said. I think that Obama does, he has a lot of conceit when it comes to his role, and he thinks that the government has, you know, all the wisdom it needs to run our lives, particularly with things like Obamacare and the overtime hour law he passed recently, and both of those things affect people that are very close to me. So it really, that kind of stuff gets me extremely hot under the collar when I read about it. But there were some things you said that I disagreed with, and I want to hear your thoughts about it. So I think you said when he did the bailout and the stimulus and all that stuff that this you saw this as kind of particularly bad part of his presidency because it threw out of the window the American idea of respecting contracts and free enterprise. And I mean, I think that the I agree that that's bad, of course, but in the past, if we look at things like, you know, FDR, when he signed his Gold Confiscation Act in 1933, my jaw dropped when I read about that. I couldn't even, it astounded me that Americans stood for that. Oh, I mean, he essentially stole from.
I think it was when Richard Nixon imposed price controls on the entire economy.
Yeah. Yeah. And also in 1971, when Nixon, I forget what it was called, but the Nixon shock, you know, where he told all the other nations in the world to, sorry, but we're not going to honor our gold agreements. You know, it amazes me that didn't start some kind of international war. It just blows my mind. But
let me agree with you, but also say this, that I think that's right, that every one of these are major events that are increasing the control of the statists and the power of government over our lives. And some of them, in a sense, as one act, things are worse. And certainly during the New Deal, you know, what the FDR did to the Supreme Court. He basically replaced the entire Supreme Court with people who would vote his way because he didn't like the way they were voting. In many respects, that was so much worse. I guess
that too. Yep.
I guess the point is that, yes, in a particular realm, that was so much worse then. And yet, we were so much freer back then than we are today. And so every one of those made America much worse. And we're at the point today where everything's controlled, everything's regulated, but we still feel like, we still think, and to some extent it's true, that when we sign a contract between two people, that's still upheld. We know the government's going to do whatever the hell they want with a dollar. We know the government's going to do whatever the hell they want with money, that they can inflate, they can deflate. All of that Richard Nixon proved to us, right? And they can confiscate our gold. That was proof. But we still thought, right, that when we have a bond, that the company that issued the bond is still required to live up to the terms of the covenant in that bond. And I think what Obama did is took one more thing out from under us, right?
So
one thing we thought was solid, no, it ain't. The government can take that away from us as well. So it's just one more shocks to the system. And I agree, to some extent, it's not a big of a shock as those, but I think it's not a big of a shock as those because those other ones affected almost everybody. And this affected like some financial institutions out there, bondholders. That's like, who cares about bondholders? But I think it's devastating because when you think about contracts and contract law and the importance of contract, this is a biggie. Now, you can give me 1,000 examples of how in other ways contract law has been undermined over the last 50 years, and they're all legit. I just think this was a watershed in terms of how the president of the United States can get involved in redefining contracts after the fact. I think it's going to have horrific consequences in the decades to come.
There's one thing I want to say in Obama's defense, which is it was a few months ago. I guess maybe it was back in 2015, but he said to a group of college students, and this is a quote, he said, "I've heard some college campuses where they don't want to have a guest speaker who is too conservative, or they don't want to read a book if it has language that is offensive to African Americans or somehow sends a demeaning signal towards women," Obama said. "I got to tell you, I don't agree with that either. I don't agree that you, when you become college students at college, have to be coddled and protected from different points of view. Sometimes I realize maybe I've been too narrow-minded. Maybe I didn't take this into account. Maybe I should see this person's perspective. That's what college in part is all about." And I'm really glad that he said that, because with all of this atmosphere we've seen about trigger warnings and safe spaces around college campuses, it would be very easy for Obama either to embrace that or to simply not speak on it. And I think it was great that at a university in front of a whole bunch of college students, where he didn't have to make these remarks, he said, you know, criticize the idea of disinviting conservative speakers and kind of push back a little bit on this chilling effect, I think, that we've seen. And so sometimes, you know, there are a lot of things that Obama has done, particularly things like Obamacare, which that is one of the things I think just defines his presidency, is Obamacare. And it drives me insane that he passed that and shoved it on the American people. But there are certain things he does and that he says where, you know, I can't hate him. I like that he says those things. And my question is, yeah.
I agree with you completely.
I was going to say, question is, do you sometimes like feel, you know, like your hatred of him or your disgust with him kind of melt away when you hear him say certain things?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I find that there are people out there who hate Obama much more than I do. I've said this before and I'll say it again. I hate Bush much more than I hate Obama. And the more perspective I think I'll get on Obama and Bush, the more I'll hate Bush and the less I'll hate Obama. I mean, that is an amazing quote from him. It's unfortunate that he doesn't recognize that it's people who share his ideology who brought these ideas into the campuses and have institutionalized them. But it's nice to see him fighting against that. And I think once in a while he said things like that that have been very powerful and true. You know, I do think he's even said stuff about race that I actually agree with. And I know that people on here who don't agree. I think race is still an issue in this country. And I know some of you don't. And I don't blame everything on that has to do with race on the blacks. I think that our culture has a lot to do with it. And I think sometimes he said some decent things about that. I still think he's an awful president, and I still think he's an awful human being, and his ideology is terrible. But I don't quite see him. I know a lot of objectivists, and I know a lot of people on, you know, who consider themselves free market people who literally view Obama is a devil incarnate. Now, when I see what he did to Israel in the last week of his president or a few weeks ago, when I see his attitude in foreign policy, he was certainly one of the worst presidents ever when it comes to foreign policy. And certainly Obamacare is a disaster. And certainly his bailouts and all that was a disaster. But yeah, once in a while he says something. And, you know, maybe thanks, Paul. Thanks for calling. I really appreciate it. One of the worst things Obama did, and maybe I'll end with this. We can't forget his famous "You didn't build that" speech. I mean, I think that was one of the low lights of his presidency, for the president of the United States to say that. Now, you have to read the whole context. It's not as bad as it sounds, but it's still really, really, really bad. It's Rawlsian. It brings that whole perspective that the left has on luck, on it takes a village. We are stronger together, Hillary's theme. It takes all that and gives it that intellectual facade that he and Elizabeth Warren have brought to that whole inequality debate. So that speech, it's important for us to remember how bad it is. So that speech really represents a lot about what Obama is. It's altruism, egalitarianism, collectivism, and in that it is those things. It's fundamentally anti-American, but I don't think we can ignore the incompetence, particularly when it comes to foreign policy. And maybe the incompetence is inevitable if you're an altruist, collectivist, and egalitarian, that the incompetence is possible. So, yes, Obama was the first president in American history to be anti-American, and maybe that's why he makes the list of one of the worst presidents in American history. It's that visceral anti-Americanism in him. It's elements of nihilism in him that are particular evil. But there's no conspiracy. There's no attempt to destroy wholesale the Western America. You know, he was not a dictator, although he was more of an authoritarianist president than most other presidents, maybe all of the presidents. And I think he'll go down as a really, really, really bad guy and as a pivotal figure, particularly because he made the election of Donald Trump possible. And I don't expect good things from Donald Trump. All right. okay, we're over time a little bit, but let me just mention, I want to say something about The Crown, this TV show that everybody's watching. I can't remember if I talked about it or not. I think I'm one episode before the end, almost finished the first season. Let me say, it's beautifully made. It's on Netflix, by the way. Beautifully made, amazingly acted. You know, really, really amazing. Somebody's correcting me. You know, yeah, he's an altruist and a collectivist. If somebody's correcting, he's evil. I'm wrong. Yeah, of course he's evil. He's evil because he's an altruist and a collectivist, and because he's fundamentally anti-American. I'm not suggesting he's good. He is evil. But is he any more evil than Woodrow Wilson or FDR or Johnson or George Bush or Nixon? You know, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know that he makes my top five worst presidents of all time. I haven't decided yet. I'm still debating who has to drop off the list in order to include Obama. All right. I know you guys are not going to agree with me. The Crown. So The Crown's beautifully made. It's amazingly done. And so on. I have to say, I'm not that interested. That's the problem I have with The Crown. I don't care about Elizabeth. I don't find myself engaged as much. I love the parts about Churchill. I wish the show was about Churchill, right? And if it was about Churchill, I think I would be a lot more engaged in it, or even if it was about the politics of that. But I just find I don't care about now it's, again, beautifully acted. I mean, amazingly acted, particularly Elizabeth. I think it's phenomenal. But, you know, I don't care about monarchs one way or the other. I don't like them. I don't like the idea of monarchy. You know, so I find it very hard to relate to it. I mean, I would have resigned. I would have abdicated. I know Ayn Rand said something positive about monarchy. I don't get it. I can't stand the idea of royalty or any kind of privileged aristocracy. And, you know, I find it uninteresting mostly. Well, there have been one or two episodes which have been really engaging and really interesting. And that's where kind of Elizabeth was strong and was engaged in doing something. Most of the time, she's just a puppet. She's doing nothing. And the whole role is of do nothing. There's a wonderful little speech there where the whole idea of the monarchy is anti-individualistic. And the whole idea of the monarch is not to be an individual. It's to represent the collective. And I don't know. It's not that it's the evil of the monarchy hasn't been dealt with. It's that I just don't find it interesting because I can't relate, identify, get engaged with any of the characters. Now, that can sometimes happen if I'm fascinated by one of the characters. I'm just not interested. And anyway, but I encourage everybody to watch it because you might get engaged with one of the characters. And I think that it's so beautifully done and it's so wonderfully acted and so amazingly produced that it's worth watching for that, and watch a couple of episodes. And if you're not engaged, you can stop, but at least give it a shot. I would definitely, definitely recommend giving it a shot. And I do think it's worth watching for Churchill alone. I wonder what's going to happen in season two when Churchill isn't there anymore. What will be the hook to keep me and some others engaged with it. So, you know, I guess we will see, but overall I recommend watching it. Although I have to say I'm not super enjoying it, and so I'm watching one other TV show, but I guess I'll talk about that next week. All right. So you've been listening to the Iran Book Show on both Blog Talk Radio and Facebook Live, and I am going to stop Facebook Live first. So thank you all for being on Facebook Live. See you next week. And before I play the music on Blog Talk Radio, we've done that, and now we can play the music on Blog Talk Radio. Same time, same place next week. Look forward to talking to all of you guys, and let people know about the show.
know about the show. Lift the thumbs up. And, I'm not as warm with